G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on Truth to You. That's truth2u.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, my friend.
G'day to you too.
Stop. Turn off your fan. It's blowing into the microphone.
No, it's too hot here. If I don't have a fan, I'm going to be cooking.
That's better.
I moved it a little.
So it's summer in Israel and it's hot. Okay, fine.
Well, it's summer in Israel. It's a bit cooler today. I mean, we've had days. There were days where I thought I was about to literally just burst in flames or something. It was so hot. I mean, I'm sitting in the house and I'm avoiding walking outside. And there were days where I'm just sitting there going, either I'm going to turn into water or I'm going to just combust or something.
We're going to do a couple of chapters today. How about that?
Two chapters, yeah. Really, what we're reaching now is like a back and forth, David Soul. And this is why they're like these pieces where it's talking about one person that's going back to another person, back and forth, because now this is the climax of the story that we're now going back and forth. It's becoming very, very rapid.
Mm.
And there's a bit of a slowdown at one point, which is the next chapter, but we're dealing. We're talking about David meeting Saul, and they're talking, and then they never meet again, and now we're focusing on David, then go back to Saul, then go back to David, because there's a point there where they almost meet again, and then something happens and they don't.
That's back and forth,
and then we reached the end of basically book one, book of Samuel. Probably the division of book one to book two is as a later division. And originally in the Hebrew Bible, there was no such thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you buy a Hebrew Bible today, you'll see Samuel Aleph and Samuel Bet. I mean, Samuel 1, Samuel 2.
But originally it wasn't so, right? It was just the book of Samuel.
Yeah, it just was the book of Samuel. The same thing with, the book of Kings. It was just the book of Kings. The thing is that these books are very, very long. You know, we've been dealing with the book of Samuel for how long now? I mean, it's been months.
Yeah. It's been, it has. You know, we're almost coming up to our, I don't know how, we've almost done 90 recordings, I think, you and I.
What, on just like
Truth to You?
Or Truth to You.
Mm.
Yeah, which by the way, you need to make sure that the other recordings are there. I mean, I know you're going to do this. And just people kept sending me emails like, oh, we want to hear your opinion about something that has to do with Sukkot. And I'm like, I did a recording with John about this almost 2 years
ago. Bear with me, dear listeners. Very, very soon, I'm going to be taking a little bit of time to focus on the website and make it easier to navigate around. That is in the pipeline. But almost 90 episodes. In any case, this is one of them, and this is the way it starts in chapter 27 of 1 Samuel. It says, David, now this is it. Yoel, as we mentioned, as we left off last week, it does begin on a low note. David said in his heart, now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me that I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines, and Saul will despair of me to seek me any more in the part of Israel, so I shall escape out of his hand. It's all a bit sort of, oh, woe is me.
The root malat here is very dominant, lehimalet, to escape, to run away. He's actually saying to himself, himalet imalet, himalet imalet. One was a hey, one with an aleph, and it's just basically a construction that says, I should do this. He's like talking to himself saying, I should really get out of here. Because it's been twice. No, I mean, it's been twice that Saul has chased him down.
Mm.
And he's saying, maybe the third time he'll get a hold of me, which is really what he's worried about. And he says, no, he's unstable. It's, again, we're seeing here, David's recognizing the unstable reality of Saul. And he says, Saul, every time he says to me, yeah, I'm so sorry, David, my son. And then it happens again.
So he's confronted him twice, and he really feels like there's nothing left for him to do but to leave. And he seems kind of depressed about that.
You know, we had the whole thing where he said, they tell me to go worship other gods in foreign lands. I mean, he doesn't like the idea. I mean, there's another thing that happens here that, he doesn't have too many options where to go to. I mean, this is probably part of the dilemma that he has. He's probably sitting
because
there.
Because let's not forget, Yoel, he's got 600 men with him, right?
Exactly. But part of what's going on with him as well, he's probably sitting there thinking, what do I do with this? I mean, where can I go?
Mm.
Moab is a problem. Ammon is a problem. Ammon is an enemy.
Mm.
To Egypt, we're not really supposed to go back to Egypt. And really, maybe Egypt was kind of like a mess at that time. I'm not too sure exactly what the situation of Egypt was back then.
It's a mess now, that's for sure.
Oh, it's a mess now, obviously. So he just sits there and he has to make a decision. Then it dawns on him, he just probably has to go with the Philistines. It's the easiest way out. But going to the Philistines is a problem, because first of all, he's the enemy of the Philistines, and we already had an encounter with the Philistines earlier. Yeah. That's number one. But then number two, the other problem that he has is if he joins the Philistines, now he joins the armies who are fighting Saul, which means he'll at one point have to confront Saul. So this is he's basically torn, but he has to also survive, and he has a responsibility over his men, because basically his men have rebelled against the crown, which means these men and their families are in danger.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. So true. And he's got to think of them. So David arose and went over with the 600 men who were with him to Achish, the son of Maoch, king of Gath. So David dwelt with Achish at Gath, and he and his men, each man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam, Hebrew.
Israelite. She's from she was from the valley of Jezreel. It's from the valley of Israel.
And Abigail, I've got the Carmelitis. Sounds so like a disease.
Well, in Hebrew, she says, Avigail, the wife of Naval, the Carmelite, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It mentions Naval. Does your text mention the name Naval?
It does. I have got Naval's widow. Yeah. So both of them are there. Of course, Michael's not there. We get to her later. But it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he sought him no more. He thought, okay, he's too far away. He's in the hands of the enemy now. Whatever, he's no longer my concern. Do you think that's possibly what's going on?
Could be. I mean, now he's all like, okay, he's gone to the enemy lines. You know, there's no I can't really go there in pursuit because I can't really enter. I can't really enter the territory.
That's right. And David said to Achish, if I have now found favor in your eyes, let them give me a place in some town in the country that I may dwell there. For why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you? Now, we commented on that last week. Now, obviously, he wanted more freedom to move around. We find out about that a little later on.
Yeah, but there's another thing that basically goes on here. I mean, he now is a servant and a vassal, and he actually has his own little army. He's not just some guy who showed up at the doorsteps of Achish and said, okay, listen, Achish, I want to be your friend. You know, let me in. He's a man that shows up with wealth. He has a little army of 600 men. That's actually an army by itself with people. So he's kind of like a miniature king.
Sure.
So by being a miniature king, because he has his own men and he has his own wealth, then he turns into what's called a vassal. Okay, he actually can make a treaty with Achish, the king of Gath. And as a vassal, he has rights to, for example, receive land or a city for him to dwell in. That was very, very common back then. So what he's asking here is not something like, it's not audacity to turn around to Achish and say this. It's actually a reasonable thing to request. Also, having 600 extra men and the families in your city, it's food, it's a garrison. It's food, it's a mess, it's the number of people, it's more work and everything. So for him, like, yeah, go to some other town, be your own mayor and take care of your own people is a great idea. You know, every country would love that, you know, pay your taxes and take care of yourself. But as long as you give us your money, we're fine with that. You know, just do whatever you want as long as you give us your money. And, you know, so I think many states would love that. They don't have to really take any responsibility over anything. Just, you know, just give us your money and take care of
yourself. Yeah. So Achish falls for that. He gives him Ziklag that day. Now, this is hang on. How do you pronounce it?
Ziklag.
Ziklag. Ziklag. And this
Ziklag.
Is a,
Ziklag.
It's a curious verse. It says, therefore, Ziklag has belonged to the king of Judah to this day. Now, that says to me that this is some sort of editorial update,
scribal
update.
Well, I have to remember, no, I don't know if it's even an update. I mean, this was probably written after David's time. I mean, I don't think that David had a scribe running after him, recording everything that he did. You know,
that's a good
point. Wait, he's like running behind him with a pen. No, it's almost going on.
Something there.
Yeah, did you say this? Everything that we're reading here, I mean, everything in these books were written sometimes, maybe decades, maybe a century after they happened. I mean, or maybe when David was finally sitting on his own throne, then they sat down to write the history of King David. Or maybe it was
good point.
King Solomon that sat down and wrote the history of King David. And maybe it was even the people of the house of King Hezekiah that sat down and wrote the story of King David. I mean, King Hezekiah, there's a hint, for example, in the book of Proverbs in chapter 25, and these are also Proverbs of King Solomon, the men, the servants of King Hezekiah collected, which it makes it sound as if the times of King Hezekiah, they started creating these texts. I mean, not necessarily the Torah. The Torah
we collating a collection of texts and putting them in some sort of chronological order. Yeah,
exactly. And maybe they were using. Notes. The other thing is that we also know that there were other people recording history. So maybe they were just, you know, taking out all the different books that they had and now editing them into one official chronicle, which basically turned into the Bible. So this is not necessarily a note that was added in later on. This is really something that they said, okay, now. This is a story of how Tziklag became a city that belongs to the house of the king. You know, this is
I was just going to say, Tziklag is still there, right? We still have a place called Tziklag.
Is there actually a place called Tziklag? I mean, there's probably actually, I have a reference that says the exact location of Tziklag is still in dispute.
Really?
Yeah.
How about that? Okay. All right. So
there are different possibilities. For example, Tel Al-Sheria. There's also Tel Asaba, Seba. There's a few names of places that might have been Tziklag. I mean, again, I'm not an archaeologist, but the possibility of 100% identification, you can't walk in and there's this huge sign saying, welcome to Tziklag, you know.
My understanding is that it is a little bit east of the northern border of Gaza.
Probably, because it's close enough to be part of the Philistine land, but it's already more towards the Negev, because then he goes out and raids, so it has to be far enough from Gath and basically the Philistine lands, so they can't really see what he's doing on one hand, but it also has to be close enough also the areas that he's raiding, because he starts raiding the western Negev.
Sure. And so he dwelled there, it says, in the country of the Philistines for one full year and 4 months, and David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites and Gerzites and the Amalekites, for those nations were the inhabitants of the land from of old, as you go to Shur, I've got, even as far as the land of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense so far. Okay, so whenever David attacked the land... He left neither man nor woman alive, but took away all the sheep and the oxen and the donkeys, the camels and the apparel, and returned to Achish. And then Achish would say, where have you made a raid today? And David would say, well, against the southern area of Judah, or against the southern area of Yerahmeelites, or against
Yerahmeel. I actually knew a person whose name was... Well, no, I actually knew a person called Yerahmeel. It's actually... I actually knew a guy, his name was Yerahmeel. It's a very unusual name, but it happens. So Yerahmeeli. And actually Yerahmeel is the saying Yerachem Ha'el, may God show mercy.
Oh, well, love.
Yeah.
And so that would be his claim. Achish bought it, and David would save neither man nor woman alive to bring news to God, saying, unless they should inform on us, saying David did this. And thus was his behavior all the time that he dwelt in the country of the Philistines. So Achish believed David, saying, he has made his people Israel utterly abhor him, therefore he will be my servant forever.
So I actually read a couple comments about this. They said that it's first of all, David, as people would say in these days' language, they would say he played him. And yeah. He tricked him into thinking that he's really turned away from his own nation. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of poking fun at Achish that he's actually...
The gullibility. He's
the gullibility. He's telling, oh, yeah, I did this and this. And he's like, oh, okay, cool. You know, he's not really checking what he's doing. And what David is doing here is he's just using tactics. Again, you know, he's trusting God, but he's using tactics, which is a very, very... how would I put this?
Well, like we said last week, he's acting as a double agent in a sense.
Yeah, he's like, you know, you remember this theme music, Secret Agent, man. No, I'm just being funny. The point is that really, I mean, you have to think about how torn he is inside about this whole thing. And sure. The fact remains that he's continuing what he promised to do. He's fighting the enemies of Israel, but he's kind of doing it from a different angle, which shows that, you know, he doesn't give up. You know, he continues doing what he has to do, even in a situation like this.
Now, this is the end, Yoel. Of course, this is the end of chapter 27. It does continue in a couple of verses 28. So let me just read those. It says, now it happened in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together to war to fight with Israel. And Achish said to David, assuredly, you know that you will go out with me to battle, you and your men. So David said to Achish, surely you know what your servant can do. So Achish said to David, well, therefore I will make you one of my chief guardians forever.
So first of all, David's going like, oh no.
Yeah, but this guy's sold. Achish is totally sold on David.
He's totally sold on David. I mean, really, really, I mean, he's kind of like going, David is the best thing after sliced bread. You know, it's just, he's completely overwhelmed by this man, which is, by the way, the character of David. Anywhere David goes, so he succeeds.
True.
Okay. Now, the other thing is that he says to him, they use the same root. So he says, and Vayomer Achish el David, and Achish said to David, Yadoa teda ki tititze b'machane. You should surely know. Yadoa teda. Again, this is an emphatic form where you double the root and you use one is in an absolute and the other one is in a finite verb. And, you know, you surely know that that you will go out with me in the field. So he's basically telling him, well, you know, you're my vassal now. So it means when I have something I have to do, you have a treaty with me. And David says, yeah, I know. Damn it. I can imagine him going like under his bed.
So they're almost about to go out into battle with each other against against Israel. I mean, how awkward. So then the curtain closes.
That's why I was making that joke, but this is very serious. He's like, oh no, how do I get out of this one? Oh man, because really, you know, and he's his bodyguards, which means there was a rule in the ancient world that you target the king.
Mm.
It was a rule in battle that you target the king, and we see this in several battles. We see it here that Saul was killed. Actually, Saul commits suicide, but for example, in the story when Jehoshaphat and Achav join in war, Achav dressed up in the clothing of Jehoshaphat, or just in regular clothing, and Jehoshaphat dressed up in the clothing of King Achav, because they knew they'll target him as the king. And the point was that he knows if he's the bodyguard of the king of Gath, then he will probably be the people break through to reach Saul. So his king can kill Saul. So it means he will have a hand in killing Saul, directly killing Saul.
Which we know he doesn't want to have a hand in that, obviously, because he's turned down that opportunity twice.
And it'll be beyond that he might be asked, I mean, they capture Saul, he'll be asked to kill Saul to prove his loyalty.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Maybe not by Achish, but by the other ministers, the other Sananim of Plishtim of this.
Essentially.
So this is like a terrible outcome. He doesn't lose his cool. He's like, oh yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm supposed to do these things. I know. He answers in the same language. He also uses the same root.
So the curtain closes on that scene, reopens, and we're totally somewhere else together. As you said, it goes David, Saul. Now we're talking about Saul. From 28 verse 3 on, we're talking about what's going on with Saul, and it reiterates the fact that Samuel had died. All of Israel lamented for him, and they buried him at Ramah in his own city. Saul had put all the – now, it's interesting. It just throws this into the mix, and Saul had put
by the way, it says in Samuel dead, and it says, and they buried him at – what does your English say?
In Ramah, in his own city.
Okay, so the English got it right, because the Vav here, a lot of people that, for example, study Hebrew – should know that there are different ways of using different conjunctions in Hebrew. I mean, it's the same conjunction, but it for example, you can mistranslate this as in Ramah and his city, which means, oh, this is buried in two places. So the English, your English translation, you got it right, means Ramah, which is his city. This is really what it means.
Right.
Okay,
very good.
So, but by the way, why do we mention the fact that Samuel is dead? Because Samuel, I think, has already died some time back. We're going back to this. There's an element in these chapters to always go back to things that were mentioned earlier, and now we're talking about this again. So it's saying, oh, Samuel's dead. Okay, so Saul no longer has anyone to talk with directly with God.
Now, Saul had put all the mediums and the spiritualists out of the land. Now, we haven't read about that before. That's new information, but it's relevant to the story we're about to dive into.
Yeah, it mentions this. But by the way, this is to point out something very important. So all these mediums and spiritualists and everything, it's not the same thing as we have today. Like, for example, someone goes to a spiritualist or something like that, and they're sitting there and a table moves and they're talking and everything. It's not the same thing. It wasn't the exact same method. There's no description how here it was done, but I actually found a source that kind of gives some information how it was done. So I'm already going to bring up this. I'm going to bring up the points of how it was done. I want the listeners to see if they actually recognize some of the things. So it says it was done at night. and they used to use some divining to actually find a spot to dig a pit, and then they had to put a food offering, and they would invoke. There was some kind of invocation ritual. And then when they were done, they had to cover the pit. Now, there's an interesting source I just read that says that the word here is Ov and Yidioni. Now, in one thing I was reading, the claim was that Ov and Yidioni are really the same thing. That's really, it's a word couple that mean the same thing. But we see in a lot of places where they translate this as two separate things. So I asked myself that question, but all the places translate these as two separate things. And the writer actually, a couple of lines later, explains that, yes, a lot of people think that these are two separate things, but it's actually the same thing mentioned in two words. So this idea is called a handidas, if you ever heard of it, which means two okay. through two, one through two. I think that's the translation, which means two things which are mentioned as one thing which is mentioned under two names, right. Which is something which is kind of common because these are what's called also referred as word couples. That sometimes you have two words that represent the same thing. Mm-hmm. For example, if you do a parallel, in poetry, if you want to create a parallel, synonymous parallel, then you mention one word and then it has a parallel, which is another word, but they really mean the same thing.
So that's not uncharacteristic of Hebrew. We have a lot of examples of that throughout the Tanakh, right?
Yeah, well, it's not only Hebrew. There's other languages that do the same thing. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that, another source I was reading said that the word Ov actually was connected to some Hittite word that meant pit, which works really well with this description. Mm-hmm. So really, they used to dig a pit, and the pit was as if you opened up a doorway into the underworld, because they believed, their belief was the earth was flat, the heaven was a dome, and mm-hmm. Sheol, the underworld, was literally underneath you. Mm-hmm. So they were looked at this as if they were digging a hole which enabled them to enter the underworld, and then they had to cover it to prevent spirits from getting out of there. You wouldn't want that. The other thing is that there's no description. the other side of it also is that we haven't, beyond that, we don't really know exactly how it worked. I mean, it's clear that it was clear that she could see him.
Yeah,
she was able to see Samuel, and it was also clear that somehow Saul was able to speak with Samuel. But what did it mean that Samuel was talking through her, was there a voice echoing? That's one discussion. And the other discussion is that does magic actually work?
There are so many questions, Yoel. There are so many questions that arise out of this chapter, this particular story. We're going to get into some of those because there's a few that I have that I've never been able to satisfy. So, and you and I have spoken of this chapter before, but let's keep going.
That was a while back,
and I don't think we recorded that. So it says, we'll deal with them as they come up. It says, the Philistines gathered together and came and encamped at Shunem. So Saul gathered all Israel together, and they encamped at Gilboa. And when Saul saw that the army of the Philistines, he saw the size of the army, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly, and Shaul inquired of Yehovah, and Yehovah did not answer him either by dreams or by the Urim or by the prophets. Now, I don't know Urim and Turim, but that's clearly what it's
referring to. It's clearly the Urim and Turim. So there's a question about how does he have access to the Urim? I mean, if Yatal took him with him.
Because he killed all the priests, right?
So there was a claim that maybe there were two of them by this point or something. But again, we don't know exactly. Or maybe it's referencing in history. That he's asked in the past and he wasn't answered, so maybe he just knows there's no point in trying to ask again. It's not really clear to me what exactly went on here.
That's a good point, but whatever it is, he's not getting any answers, so he goes to the last resort, right?
The other thing is also dreams. I mean, what does it mean that he dreams? I mean, first of all, we know that he did prophesy for an ecstatic prophecy at least at some point. We mentioned that. But also, there's an issue here with what does it mean that he went to try to dream dreams? So I actually found a record that explains how it was done, and the way it was done is that people, I think, would ask a question before they go to sleep, and they would sleep near either a holy site or a holy object, and they would think that they believe that the holy object or the holy site will radiate or resonate some holiness towards them, which will create a kind of psychic link with God, and mm-hmm. then the question will be answered, and they will receive an answer through a dream. Now, sometimes the answer was straightforward, yes, no, stuff like that, but or an actual sentence, or you know, a form of prophecy, or that it was in some kind of like image, like for example, you know, him doing something or seeing some kind of a symbol, and then he has to interpret that. There's different ways of looking at it.
So what about, surely, stories such as Jacob at Bethel, or Joseph in Egypt, the dreams that were interpreted and so on and so forth, would that not play a part in the hope that, you know, if Yehovah's not going to talk to me via the Urim and the Tumim, maybe he'll talk to me in a dream? It's happened before. We know about that. Maybe that'll happen. But no, in this case, no.
Yeah.
Okay. So in any case, he thinks, well, I need something because I'm really, really concerned. And he says to his servants, find me a woman who is a medium that I may go to her and inquire of her. Now, the first thing that comes to my head, Yoel, Balaam, infamous, you wouldn't call him a prophet. What would you say he was? He was a seer.
So one place he's called a magician.
Mm-hmm.
Another place he's looked as if he's a dreamer of dreams.
Yeah.
He can curse people. He can bless people.
Would you potentially put him in the medium basket, medium spiritualist basket?
He might have also been a medium. You never know. I mean, it seems that Balaam was a guy who was very, very spiritual on one hand, but he went to the direction of what we would call the dark arts.
Mm.
And he probably practiced everything possible.
He was on the dark side of the force. But in this case, Saul asks for a woman specifically. Why would that be?
So the practice was that usually the old women were the ones who did this stuff. It was part of the specifications.
Really?
Women, for some reason, were the best mediums for such a thing. Maybe it was through experience. They had men who tried it, women tried it, and there was more success with women. But it's specifically also an old woman. It can't be a young woman. It has to be an old woman.
Hmm.
Now, okay. the other side of it as well is this might be the history of the whole thing of the witches. Why do you always have witches as like the evil ones?
Yeah, it's characteristic as women for the most part. Yeah,
because in the ancient world it was apparently women were the best mediums. They had women involved in as priests as priestesses. They had women involved with magic, and for some reason women was just the most powerful mediums for this stuff.
Okay,
This was the reputation. I mean, for example, you also look in Jeremiah. It seems that, for example, Jeremiah, when he's prophesizing against the people who ran to Egypt, it was women were the ones heavily involved in the occult of the heavens, or the queen of the heavens. So there's something about women back then that seemed to be that they were a lot more spiritual, had different abilities than men do. And I think even today women, because women are, they tap into something a bit more spiritual than men do.
Perhaps. You know? I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't know about, you know, the clairvoyance and mediums of today, but I don't know what the ratio would be. But in any case,
From the advertising I've seen throughout the years, it's mostly mm-hmm. women who are involved with tarot cards and reading coffee cups and tea leaves and whatever, all this stuff. It's usually women.
Very curious. And in this case, Saul does ask, Shmuel asks for a woman who is a medium. His servant said to him, in fact, there is a woman who is a medium at Endor. So Saul disguised himself. He put on other clothes and he went, and the two men with him. And they came to the woman by night, and he said, please conduct, this is what I've got, Yoel, please conduct a seance for me and bring up for me the one I shall name to you. Seance, what do you have?
So it says, Kasmina Libaov. So Kesem is a wondrous act, and he asks specifically through the thing called an Ov, which is really an issue of bringing up a spirit from the underworld. Now, the thing is that, from what also I read, the person who's ordering the science is also involved, because he has to say the name of the person and then speak with the person. Then this is what we see here. So there's a little bit of hinting here how it was actually done.
Mm, a little bit, just a little bit. And so the woman said to him, look, you know that Saul, you know what he's done. I mean, he's cut off the mediums and the spiritualists from the land. Why do you lay a snare for my life to cause me to die?
So here she's using a different verb. I mean, it says in verse 3 that he removed, he dispositioned, he removed mm-hmm. all these types of mediums. Mm-hmm. Here she's using the word hichrit, to cut off. She's using a different verb. It kind of gives a bit of her emotions about this. She's concerned, but it maybe also expresses a bit of anger, because we have to remember this is popular religion. This is popular practice for a sure. lot of people back then, which meant that they know this is our spiritual way. Why are you trying to remove what we're used to? It kind of gives us a bit of a hint what was going on back then with the True. Israelites. I mean, if she is an Israelite, and we assume she is, because if she wasn't Israelite, he wouldn't have any authority and probably wouldn't even be bothered if she was a medium.
And maybe it's part of her ruse. I mean, maybe she does this with every new client, and she plays the, what do you want? You come to me to be a spiritualist? Don't you know that Shaul has gotten all of those out of the land? What do you think I'm going
to... No, but the fact that it's adjacent to the previous, maybe the verse 3 probably means that this is not a ruse that she does. That she's actually, you know... She's concerned, but maybe this is her quite ruse sincere. Now. Maybe she's quite sincere. But when I think about it, on the other hand, this is what she does to avoid certain situations. But if some, you know, because maybe this is Saul's police running around trying to find people. So maybe this is something that she developed when they started cutting, you know, killing all these.
Yes.
Assume killing all these mediums.
She's cautious.
It's also possibly what you said, but maybe she's also being sincere.
So this is now verse 10, Yoel, is really odd. Saul then, Shaul swore to her by Yehovah, saying, as Yehovah lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing. Now what she's about to do is clearly anti-Torah, but he's invoking the name of God, saying that no punishment shall come upon you if you go against the Torah.
But as I pointed out, this is popular religion for them. They didn't really care if it fits the laws of the Torah or not. We have the same situation today here in Israel with Kabbalists, mm-hmm. with people. For example, I met these people that use that go to these mediums and everything. And these are, you know, you go to this medium and she's like, you know, she has a mezuzah in her entrance and she uses a lot of religious symbols mm-hmm. and she has a head cover and she maybe even keeps Shabbat and everything. But this is their spiritual way of doing things. And when you tell them, you know, this is against Torah, they go like, don't tell me what the Torah actually says. I am a spiritualist. I know what God really wants from us. Mm-hmm. And this is probably part of the attitude here as well. That she has no difficulty saying, "No, I'm a spiritualist. I know what I'm doing. I know there's no problem with this."
So she seems satisfied with Shaul swearing to her by Yehovah that she'll be in the clear. And so she says, "Well, who will I bring up for you?" And he says, "Bring up Samuel for me." Now this is where it gets really weird. When the woman saw, this is verse 12. When she saw Samuel, she cried out in a loud voice. And the woman spoke to Shaul, saying, why have you deceived me? You are Saul. You are Shaul. And the king said to her, do not be afraid. What did you see? And the woman said, now this is crazy, Yoel. This requires some explanation.
But
the woman said,
but you should know what the answer is because we spoke about this.
Come on. The woman said to Shaul, I saw Elohim ascending out of the earth.
And?
Well, come on. I saw Elohim coming. What do you mean, and? Let everyone know. What does this mean? What are we talking about?
Well, you're asking how the word Elohim is being used here.
Well, this is what I've got in my New King James. I've got a spirit. But where is Elohim used as a spirit? I don't believe I have that anywhere else in the Tanakh. Sometimes it's used as judge, and I can understand that. It's used like that in the Torah. It's used like that in the Psalms. But primarily it's used for God. In this case, I saw a spirit ascending out of the earth, but the word is Elohim.
So the answer I found for this one was that Elohim here is used to emphasize something much greater than what she's ever seen before. I mean, usually she summons a spirit and the spirit shows up. Here she saw something that she's never seen before. This is a spirit that resonates greater power than anything she's ever seen before. Mm-hmm. And it shows up in a way that's unusual. So it could be one of the. She's alarmed because what she sees is different, and it's beyond that. She sees a great spirit. Mm. This is not some, you know, spirit. Oh, I'm bringing up some spirit. This spirit showed up probably in its full form. This is maybe what happened. Maybe usually what they saw was maybe she saw like a kind of kind of like a vague thing hovering there. Mm-hmm. But here she saw a full form of a spirit, which scared her because she's never seen something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's why she used the word Elohim, because she's like, that can't be a spirit. That must be God or something, or a God, because spirits don't show up like that. That might be her. That might be why she reacted. She wasn't expecting so something like that.
Potentially, Yoel, a better translation in my New King James might have been, and the woman said to Shaul, I saw a God ascending out of the earth. This is the reason why she cried out in a loud voice.
She thinks it's a God, and she actually means God.
Now, whatever
the spirit
it was,
showed up, just, and it's full form because she sees a man wearing a coat and everything, and maybe maybe up to now, all she saw was some kind of like a vague thing hovering there. That's really
we're left to imagine that this mighty apparition that caused her alarm identified Shaul, and because how else did she know all of a sudden that Shaul is there before her, that's who it is, that it is the king.
Maybe Samuel's spirit kind of went, yes, Saul, what do you want? And perhaps she's like, what? And she turned around and go, what?
So she's freaking out. And he says,
she's freaking out.
He's just, what is his form? Just tell me, what is his form? And she said, now this is something I still have a problem with, boys and girls. I don't mind admitting this. There's some elements here that I've given a lot of thought to. And I would love to know what other people think. But this is verse 14. She said, an old man is coming up, and he is covered with a mantle. Spirit clothes, Yoel. We've got spirit clothes in the Bible. What's that about?
No, but the me'il, the cloak that he wears is a symbol of him. He shows up. Okay, again, we have to remember something. We don't know what the spiritual world looks like, if it even looks like anything that we can see. This is why, for example, a spirit might show up in a form that we could recognize, but maybe the real form of the spirit is something different. Here he shows up with a coat or a something which is recognizable as being Samuel. He's there, it's an old man, big whoop. He wears a coat. He wears a me'il. He's covered with a specific type of clothing. That's the identification of Samuel, because the me'il is an element about his character. Same thing, for example, with Elijah, that he wears he has like long hair, and he wears hairy cover and a leather belt and everything. So the same thing here. The coat is a symbol of it being Samuel, because you say, oh, I see an old man, big whoop. So no, but the coat is what identifies Samuel.
Okay, so I can appreciate that, but then I have to think, well, is she having some kind of a vision? Has she actually brought up a soul, a spirit because we know that he was buried. Has she actually brought him up from Sheol? It's so very curious. Why is he identified with the mantle? Well, we know that he wore a mantle. I mean, I don't think that when I die and I'm buried, that I'm going to take my a spirit of my favorite woolen jumper with me. Do you know what I mean? It's just
no.
I don't know.
Again, as I said, he shows up in a specific form to be so you can identify.
Sure.
Him.
Sure. Now who does that then? Is this something that Yehovah would do? I mean, I know these are.
We don't. I really have no way of answering that. I mean, last time I checked, this stuff is forbidden.
Is it really?
You know, so I've never tried any of it.
No, that's good. Don't go trying it. But isn't it bizarre? Spirit clothes, boys and girls. I would love to know what the listeners think about that.
I don't think you're getting overexcited about the spirit clothes thing. I think you're thinking, you're giving it too much thought. The thing you should think about is the issue of the spiritual world. I mean, first of all, this proves that the Bible believes. Unlike, for example, I heard this commentator claim that, oh, the Bible doesn't believe in the soul. It doesn't believe in an afterlife. But look, the fact remains that she was able to bring up a soul of Samuel, and the Bible accepts this. The Bible accepts the idea. But the thing is that it accepts the usual Mesopotamian belief that people died and went to a place called Sheol. There was no heaven or hell, as we pointed out already before. And it seems if you go to sleep there. So she just woke him up out of his sleep. So it means that the spirits can be aware of what's happening around them if they're invoked to wake up.
And he seems interrupted, doesn't he? I mean, you say that it's like a sleep, but because he said it's all perceived that it was Samuel. Now, we don't know what the nature of that perception was either. We don't know if he just realized.
I think just based on the description that she gave him, he realized that was Samuel. It actually worked.
That was good enough for him. And he stooped with his face to the ground and he bowed down. And Samuel said to Saul, why have you disturbed me? He's interrupted, right? Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?
Yeah, to bring him up specifically, and also to bring him up out of Sheol.
Yeah, I was in the middle of a game of checkers with Abraham and now
I was middle of taking a nap.
Deal with you. I was taking a nap and now I'm woken up. So Saul answered, I am deeply distressed, for the Philistines make war against me, and God has departed from me and does not answer me anymore, neither by prophets or dreams, and therefore I have called you that you may reveal to me what I should do.
By the way, notice that he doesn't say the word Urim.
No, he doesn't. That's right.
He doesn't want to mention what he did.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. He doesn't mention the Urim and the Tumim. So, yeah, that's right. Samuel says to him, he just states the obvious. He says, well, why do you ask me, seeing Yehovah has departed from you and has become your enemy? And Yehovah has done for him as he spoke for me. Now, who is the him? Are we talking about Yehovah or are we talking about David? How do you read that?
Yeah, the subject here is God. So the law, the preposition here is referencing back to God. So Vayas and Nailo means he did his own will. He fulfilled his wish.
Fair enough. 17.
His plan. I think that's what it actually means.
He's working his plan. And so Yehovah has done for himself as he spoke by me. For Yehovah has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David because you did not obey the voice of Yehovah, nor execute his fierce wrath upon Amalek. Therefore, Yehovah has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, and this is the moreover that he didn't want to hear. Moreover, Yehovah will also deliver Israel with you into the hand of the Philistines. And tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. Yehovah will also deliver the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines. So there's his death sentence, right?
He's telling you, you're going to die. And it's very interesting here is that though Saul is sinned against God to a point that he's actually being punished, he's still going to this place called Sheol, which kind of like completely undermines the idea of heaven and hell in general. There's no good or bad place to go. You just go to this place where you dwell there.
Mm, of course. And this horrifies Sheol. Now, can I just ask you a question? I mean, why his sons as well? I mean, why Jonathan? Why do you think that's the case? Why not just Saul? I mean, he's the one that's kind of put his foot in it. He's the one that didn't obey.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
It contradicts our knowledge of Torah. It contradicts the issue of not punishing a son for his father's deeds.
Unless, I mean, we don't really know. That's a good point, Yoel. It's a really good point. We don't really know if Jonathan had a hand in bringing back some of the booty from...
Maybe he was involved with the whole story with the Amalekites, so he had to die as well.
Maybe. We don't know. I mean, nothing is mentioned.
Or
but
maybe,
what we do
maybe
read,
he's collectively punished with the rest of Israel. This is why at least two or three of his sons die, because this is also collective punishment against Israel.
That's a good point, too. So Yehovah will deliver the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines. So there it is. There's the death sentence pronounced on Sheol. And immediately Sheol fell full length on the ground and was dreadfully afraid because of the words of Samuel. And there was no strength in him, for he hadn't eaten any food all day and night. And the woman came to Saul and saw that he was severely troubled and said to him, look, your maidservant has obeyed your voice. I put my life in my hands, in my hands. Now, and heeded the words which you spoke to me. Now, therefore, please heed.
So, by the way, there's a few things here. First of all, it could be that he collapsed because he was hungry, but it was a combination together with the severe words. But it's also very interesting. The character of the woman, the witch from Ein Dor, she's not a bad person.
She really feels for him. I think
she's not depicted as a bad person.
Mm.
This is a massive difference. She's not this evil witch. She's actually a nice person. She just practices things which are forbidden. And this is how she's depicted. Also, she uses an interesting term. She says, "Va'asim nafshi bechapin," I put my soul in my hand. And I try to look up because we've seen this before. We mentioned the whole thing of like the hand being a representative of an action and endangering yourself. And I found another interpretation that says that to put your hand around your own neck, because the word nefesh, we explained this some time back when we talked about the issue of it meaning throat when we were talking about Yom Kippurim, and it means so like as if you put your hand in your own throat, you're strangling yourself.
Mm, really good point.
That was really another idea I saw her explain it.
That's really interesting, and I think that's very fair. And that's what she did too. And she did what was forbidden. She did it at the request of the king. And now she's saying, listen, heed also to the voice of your maidservant. Let me set a piece of bread before you that you may eat and have strength when you go on your way. But he refused and said, I will not eat. So his servants, together with the woman, urged him, and he heeded their voice. Then he arose from the ground and sat on the bed. The woman had a fatted calf in the house. Imagine that.
By the way, that's probably the only calf she actually had. So she's being very hospitable. She's feeding him. She's taking care of him. She's not a bad person.
I like to think that it wasn't in the house. I like to think it was like in a pen next to the house. But in any case,
it doesn't mean in her house. It means because okay. The house can also probably mean the property around her house.
So she hastened to kill it, and she took, and this is all at nighttime, right, Yoel? And she took flour, and she kneaded it, and she baked unleavened bread from it, and she brought it before Shaul and his servants, and they ate, and they rose and went away that night. Do you know what? I have to, this brings me back to Genesis chapter 18. Abraham is sitting at the door of his tent, and three men appear before him, and one of them, is representative, particularly speaks in the first person with Abraham later on in the chapter, in the voice of Yehovah. The other two are messengers that go down to look for Lot and to Sodom and Gomorrah. And but the interesting thing about that, and I don't know that there's anything in it, but Abraham rushes to kill the fatted calf as well, and also prepares, if I remember correctly, unleavened bread to set before them. When I slaughter a goat and then I'll skin it and remove the offal and then I'll butcher it and then I'll select some pieces to cook and to do that, but also then to knead the flour and to make unleavened bread. I reckon there's got to be a couple of hours in this.
No, to make unleavened bread, I mean, I make unleavened bread in like minutes. That's not a problem.
Okay,
and if you're slaughtering
an
animal and you target specifically certain pieces to cook them quickly, then that shouldn't take too much time either. I mean, if you're in a hurry, you can probably do this in less than an hour.
All right. I'm going to give her an hour then, at least. I'm going to say an hour. So some time, in any case, some time does pass. And there are some interesting parallels. Maybe there's nothing in it, but there are some interesting parallels with Genesis 18.
It's a very similar idea. It's the issue that you're trying to be hospitable to someone and you want to feed them, so you do things very, very quickly. So there's no time for the bread to rise, so you make matzo bread. If there's not enough time to do this, you pull out pieces of meat that go quickly.
As you point out, she's not a bad person. We know when we look at Genesis 18, there's a lesson, a very obvious lesson in regards to Abraham's hospitality.
She's very hospitable. So
she's extending that hospitality.
Yeah, which is a classic thing. For example, I had it was really funny. There was this couple that came to my house. They surprised me. I wasn't expecting them. They walked into the house. They're from Europe. And they walked in. Oh, there's guests. What's the first thing you do? You offer food. So right in the kitchen, I made a whole pile of stuff and walked out with it, and like looking at one another, going like, what? This is, yeah, when you have guests, you have to feed them. They walk in and you put something out, either fruit, you put out something to drink. It's a rule, this is how you deal with people. But the thing is, for example, the English, for example, don't do that. You walk into the house, they might offer you a cup of tea, but that's basically what will happen. Sure. With Americans, I haven't been to many American houses, but I was offered something to eat when I walked in, or at least drink something. So it's something very common. But here in the Middle East, you kind of sometimes even go out your way and you make a full meal if you have to. This is really what's going on. She's also trying now she knows it's Saul. She's also trying to probably avoid any danger, so she's trying to appease him, so he remembers that she was good to him, and then he'll leave her alone.
Yes, yeah, and I'm sure that's in the back of my mind too. So that is chapter 28. That's 27 and 28. We did it. That was pretty good. I know there's a lot of questions in regards to 28 in particular.
Well, we didn't answer. We didn't really talk directly about one question I brought up, because you had your own questions. And the question is,
go on.
Does the Bible actually believe that this stuff works? And the answer is probably yes.
I think so too. I mean, listen, there are some things that the Bible mentions. For example, like the staff of the Egyptian magicians that turns into a snake. They had the ability to do that. We don't know how. We don't know what their incantations were. But there are some things that we just don't have explanations for, right?
Yeah, there's no explanation. We just don't know how they did it. It's just the fact remains that they did.
It's probably best we don't know. So we would love to hear from listeners if you have anything to add in regards to 28. Very curious verse. Next week is chapter 29 when we hear about, well, the Philistines are in fear of David becoming a Satan to them. We'll hear about that.
Well, I heard about these satanic verses.
The satanic verses that we did, myself and Jason Spiritual Babies. You can see the video on the website in regards to that. And there is a verse that we take from 1 Samuel chapter 29, but we will get there. In fact, you know what, Yoel? I reckon we're going to do 29 and 30 next week. Thank you, my friend, for coming back onto Light of the Prophets. Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page that is thrashing truth to you at the moment by a couple of hundred fans.
Almost 200.
Yep.
But people, seriously, look, Jono's behind me. Go like his page. Knock it off. He's a friend. So what if I'm an unstoppable force? So what? It's Jono. He's a wonderful man. Go like his page, please.
He is an unstoppable force at the moment. Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page. Thank you, my friend, for coming back on to Truth to You. And until next time, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom. Kol tov.